What does that mean?
That's a hell of a...
But I didn't do much. It's really pretty easy. I kind of actually enjoyed it.
Yeah, I hope you did. I got two nieces, and I babysat them the other day for like 2 hours. And that was about all I could do. It just was...
Yeah.
Like walking into a hurricane.
Well, see, I mean, one of mine's 10, so it's like, go dress your sister. You know what I mean? Which helps a bunch. But earlier today, I about lost my mind. I was like cooking breakfast, and I was just like, everybody, get out of the kitchen! It's like, oh! But, yeah, it's... It has its ups and downs, but I mean, dude, there's just nothing like it. Like, after a while, your kids become your best friends, and you just sit back and you stare at them, and you're like, I don't really want to hang out with anybody else, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, that seems to be the formula. So when do you have the conversation that daddy is a synchromystic?
I've already had it with the oldest. She understands. She started early on figuring things out. Like, I raised my eyebrow because I truly think that there's some kind of 100th monkey thing going on where it's going to be easier for the next generation to grasp. To us, you know, I don't know about you, but when I started understanding really like the ins and outs of how synchromysticism worked, it was like, well, it changes your worldview. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, well, everything, even because I was all over synchronicity before I was out of high school. And my mom used to teach me things like, you know, she always used to say stuff like things happen in threes. And if something like this happens, then pay attention because it might happen again and things like that. But, you know, truly looking at how it happens in pop culture, like, blew my mind. And then,
hi, Daddy.
Hi, baby. And then my daughter one time was like, hey, Dad, you know, I noticed that during my birthday, Mr. Popper Penguin came out. Mr. Popper's Penguins. And during my sister's birthday, Happy Feet opened up. And I think that means something, Dad. That's when I raised my eyebrow and started pointing stuff out. And I've also done experiments with them. Like I set my kid down with the VLC player. I don't know if you know what VLC is, but
yeah, I got that. Yeah,
this is Synchromystic's best friend because it can take stills and you can slow down the picture and stuff like that. I set her down with a VLC with one of, I think it was Caroline. I had taken stills from Caroline before. And so I'd set her down. I was like, okay, I want you to watch this movie on my computer. And anytime that you have like a scene that is kind of weird to you or it's just something interesting has happened, I want you to take a still. And her stills lined up with my stills almost exactly. I think she had a few more than I did.
That's fascinating, ma'am.
Yeah, to me it is. To me it really is. And, you know, I've noticed it in other places too. Like, you know... Jim Saunders is usually attributed to finding the whole 42 looks like the symbol of Jupiter thing.
Okay.
And I was talking to my friend one time, and I was telling him this different stuff, but I didn't say anything about 24, 42. And I just brought up the symbol of Jupiter, and he goes, hey, that's a 24. Like, it seemed so easy for him. Do you know what I mean? It was
absolutely.
Like...
Absolutely.
To me, it makes sense that we're pushing the boundaries of, you know, the thought process, and it's becoming, and I think that it's showing up. A lot of people get frustrated because they think people are stealing their work, and I'm just like, no, we're just all messing around in the same stew. Of course, this goes back to that argument we've been having for the last day on Facebook. Okay, Kylea. This is getting a little crazy.
Which I think is... really the argument that you're referencing, upstairs. I guess maybe we should frame it for the listener. I think I personally am reading it as mostly tongue-in-cheek, especially with the kind of demeanor that Mark LeClaire usually shows. If anything, I'm sure he thanks you completely for rustling him out of some complacency.
Inspiring him? Yeah.
Absolutely, lighting a fire, because that dude, when he's on, can spin some of the most thought-provoking work out of anyone I've ever read, and then just completely drop off the face of the planet.
Right.
I'd rather have him in the game than not in the game. And I'm sure that he feels likewise. But anyways, this argument that we, me and Will, are kind of referencing stems from a blogger whose blog title goes by the name Subliminal Synchrosphere, which I don't know who he is. I guess a few people do. It's a pretty in-depth, detailed blog. It has it follows the format of most synchromystic blogs with links, pictures, showing, you know, connections. But he takes a very conspiratorial bent and says that...
Did he cite anybody? I mean, does he cite... I didn't read the whole thing. I looked through the whole post, but I didn't actually read the post because I couldn't get past the...
You know, I kind of feel like it's... you know, synchromystic data seems to be like Scrabble tiles, and everyone seems to be able to just reach in the established bag of Scrabble tiles and arrange them to form some sort of argument to prove a point. And he doesn't seem to...
I don't think that my issue is not with the work. My issue was never it had anything to do with plagiarism at all, because... And I've tried to talk about this before, and I've always come off wrong, because it's weird, because individuals, I mean, like, I got emails one time from when Jake put out a video, and everybody was like, well, don't you feel that Jake's kind of stealing your thunder? He's kind of using aspects that you just made a video about, and he's making another video or whatever. And it, you know, and then of course we have the whole issue with Goro Adachi and his relationship to Jake and how it was stealing work or something along those lines. I don't think the issue that I had with that particular blog post that you were talking about was with plagiarism. It was all, it was his animate, you know, him pronouncing that he is not a synchhead, you know what I mean? Like, I don't think this has anything to do with Zen. But then he, you know, regardless of what you think about other individuals' work, you don't say they're stupid and then...
I hear what you're saying.
you know, you don't say that they're stupid and then go through years of work. And maybe I'm wrong and think of that. Maybe I was just being – I don't – you know, my wife laughed at me because I always tell her not to argue on Facebook. And she's like, oh, so you're arguing on Facebook. But it just rubbed me the wrong way. I mean, I looked down his whole post and I'm like, yeah, that's some good shit. Yeah, I can see where he added onto this. Or, yeah, you know, I was just about to write a post about similar stuff. That's crazy. This guy's great. And then I go back up to the top of the thing, and he's like, to be clear, I'm not a Zen. This is all conspiracy. But he said it in such a sarcastic way as to be like, anybody who thinks otherwise has obviously not got it.
Yeah.
And, I mean, that's to me is a few – that's like – it's a useless argument. That's like arguing on, you know – It just totally misses the point. Like, fine. And that's why I brought up Mark LeClaire, because Mark LeClaire obviously has made it apparent to everyone that, you know, he thinks this is a big cabal doing all of this. Which I don't, you know, I could care less. He's not derogatory towards the other individuals who think otherwise. I mean, okay, I'll admit that perhaps certain individuals who are on the other side of the fence have been derogatory towards him, perhaps even myself. But, you know, overall, I was just talking to Alan about this. Overall, Mark LeClaire is a very nice person.
But his argument needs to be qualified like pretty heavily before to even see what it is that his position ultimately is. Like, he thinks it's a cabal, but the cabal is beyond people's who are participating, like, in certain ways beyond their own scope, because their own abilities are transcending, like, their conscious awareness in certain ways. So, you know, it's not as straightforward as that.
Yeah, kind of like that Stanley Kubrick, the director, is working in service of Stanley Kubrick, the unconscious genius, using Stanley Kubrick, the director. That's what I get out of it.
Yeah. Are we having LeClaire on the show today?
Mr. Mark is unable to join us. He let me know about an hour ago.
Because, you know, I hate to put words and, you know, describe something for somebody, because he would describe it best himself. I'm sure he'd be like, okay, and then he would break it down for us. But the way that he looks at Kubrick in terms of Saturn makes me feel like, well, you know, if he's looking at Saturn as an intelligence, and, you know, obviously the description is not the described, you know, you can't, it's hard to take a position at that point in terms of what it means for somebody to be manipulating something, because if the thing manipulating it is surpassing, you know, if he looks at the intelligence as Kubrick is the intelligence of Saturn, then Kubrick is obviously tapped into a greater intelligence that's transcendent of you know.
To me, that's
brain.
Just details, though. That's like arguing over whether all UFOs are aliens or not. You know what I mean? Like, it totally misses the point that there's okay, we can all agree that there's UFOs, just like we can all agree that there's sync. I just don't understand why it seems to me that the conspiracy side, and I consider myself an individual who's got feet in both, you know what I mean? I like kind of fool around with both, and on one day I might think it's more of a conspiracy, on the other day it's like obvious to me that it's cosmic consciousness or whatever, but it comes to the point where you're like, okay, there's multiple things going on here, but there's no need to like be derogatory to anybody else's opinion.
No.
Does that make sense to?
Of course.
And if you have perhaps to, I'm guilty of doing the same thing, so I can't even talk. But Jesus, I mean,
it can be telling of someone's own. Like, if you're certain of something, there's usually no reason to argue. Like, if you're passionate about something, that's something else, you know. But even so. If you are really convinced of something and you're not questioning it, there's usually less of a tendency to attack if it's challenged. Like, if you attack if something's challenged, that's, you know, generally speaking, kind of a clear sign that you're not completely absolute and you're in conflict with yourself around it. I mean, not to generalize too much in that way, but I think that there's some truth to that.
Well, here's a perfect example. There was a comment I made up at the kitchen sink group about questioning if creativity at the highest level could elicit postpartum depression, and which I was just thinking outside of my head, right? And Pearl Shanter wrote a comment explaining what postpartum depression is and why that would be impossible. That But to make a long story short, not even a long story short, a short story shorter, I took offense to that and wrote off some sort of dismissive comment. And I realized the only reason I did that was because she was more technical than I had really thought it out to be. And I was trying to posture myself as, I went to nursing school. I studied postpartum depression. I know what I'm talking about. And when I really thought about it, I was just feeling defensive about a blind spot in my knowledge, you know? And it was a helpful kind of situation for me to kind of check myself and recognize that kind of behavior is just going to block me out from advancing my understanding. So when a blogger like the subliminal synchrosphere throws out that, you know, that gauntlet that just demolishes or takes away seemingly half of the synchronistic community, that just means that he's not willing to open his mind to certain parts of information or certain angles, and that kind of just damages the quality of his product, because
Oh wow, I'm surprised at that because I've gotten a lot out of his blog, and I didn't feel that he was. I mean, I didn't get the sense that he was like taking that ultimate position in that way, you know. And people can feel different things from day to day too, and they can feel strongly right. about them from day to day. Who knows how right. he'll feel, you know, a month or a year from now, you know?
Right.
So, you know.
I just think it was unnecessary. I mean, I can understand the guy saying, "Hey, you know, I think that this is, I don't know. It was just the tone. It turned me off, and I thought about it, and then I put something up there, and then I felt like I had to defend myself after a while, and I probably should have just stopped at that. Alan told me I came off as a person who was trying to defend themselves on the internet, who it just took it too far or something like that. So, you know, perhaps I learned a lesson more than anything, and I'm probably guilty of the same things I got frustrated with. So there's probably a certain amount of reflection going on there. It is interesting to me what sync does to your ego, though, because I've learned a lot. Just as an example, you know, I said this has little to do with sync, but overall conspiracy and how we become attached to our own opinions. There was an occasion where my friend set me down to a certain video called September Clues. Have you guys ever seen this?
I checked out some of it.
Mm-mm. And immediately, you know, when it first started off, I looked at him and goes, "Okay, dude, I don't. Why do I need to watch this? I know there was a plane," I said to him. Like, I know that there was a plane. And by the end of it, I didn't know what the hell I saw that day. Do you get what I mean?
Absolutely.
But there's this whole heated argument, you know, of people who automatically write off other individuals because they're like, "Oh, well, this guy believes that there was no plane. Obviously, he's crazy." Do you know what I mean? There's some kind of stance that our ego takes. And fooling around with sync, it actually challenges that. I will say, though, that to me, I feel that individuals who get past – I think that if you come at this through a conspiratorial viewpoint – that everything that you see will be translated through that. And if you break through that, it opens your head up to even you're playing with a bigger sandbox.
But you could just as easily be burying your head in the sand by seeing everything in terms of cosmic consciousness and synchronicity as well. You could be missing whole games that are going on, you know, that are,
certain individuals who will remain nameless are extremely guilty of that. Extremely. Just, I don't even talk, you know, I don't even want to talk about conspiracy theory. Now, other individuals like Jake Kotze, who seems to amass a lot of negative attention for whatever reason. I think it's some sort of shadow displacement, you know, because he's so butterfly, sunshine, and rainbow that certain individuals take out their anger on him. I can understand why he won't mention, you know, conspiracy theories and shit like that, because he doesn't want the attention anymore. But if you go back and you read his old stuff, he's, you know.
Yeah, well, the way he explained it to us is he actually, when we had him on, he was just like, "To be honest, I don't care. I'm not interested in that." Like, if he's like, "I don't doubt that that could be going on, but that's not where I'm putting my attention." And like that, I mean, fuck it. Yeah, I can dig it. Where are you putting your energy and where are you putting, you know, and that's how he's oriented. And he's straight up like, "This is how I'm oriented." And it's like, okay, you know, but the fact that he expressed that this could easily be going on top of this, he's just more interested in what's happening in the midst of that. And that's what, you know, excites him. And so by all means, follow what excites you. Don't, you know, he doesn't want to waste his focus on those things. And so, cool, you know, whatever.
Can you imagine?
No, that's it.
Yeah. I was just going to say, can you imagine if a giant butterfly had flown into the World Trade Center and demolished the tower?
Mothra?
Yeah, and that made me think of Mothra and how Japan kind of, in some anti-Kotzean way, took the horrors of the nuclear war, and you have Mothra coming to Japan to destroy the cities. Not sure how that really
relates to anything whatsoever. But
the Godzilla thing with Fukushima was interesting nonetheless. I mean, Godzilla was made from radiation and frozen in an ice cap, and then the ice cap gets released and he emerges from the sea, you know. But just like, I kept on seeing Godzilla references everywhere that were actually unconnected with Fukushima in terms of who was presenting it, and it was weird. Like, right after that, I was like, Godzilla's everywhere, and that fucking song by Blue Oyster Cult, Godzilla, kept on coming on. I was like, what the hell?
Oh, no, there goes Tokyo. Oh, no, Godzilla. Yeah.
And I thought it was interesting that there are two popular songs that come to mind are that and The Reaper. So Seasons Don't Fear the Reaper, nor does the Wind and the Song of the Rain. We Can Be Like They Are, and how connected they are if you look at Godzilla as nuclear fallout.
But just to take the mega ritual of Nagasaki and Hiroshima and the sort of Japanese cinematic interpretation with Godzilla and Mothra and all those super radiated organic monsters, that almost Jake Kotze's butterflies that emerged out of the mega ritual of 9/11, that out of that tragedy, it brought him to an understanding of joy. And like, there's two directions that you could have gone at falling in the fallout after tragedies like that. I don't know.
Well, to bring it back, I mean, I just think that most everybody who's in this field, especially because, all right, if you're highlighting somebody's work, you have to understand that people like Jake Kotze have done an enormous amount of work. Do you know what I mean? Like his blog, if you read his Brave New World Order blog, it's going to take you 3 months to get through. If you sit down and watch all of his videos, it's going to take you a day to get through them. And the work that he put in that is probably double that. You know, it probably took him double the amount of time it's going to take you to read it. And the guy's no spring chicken. I mean, the guy has done a lot of research. I've caught him, you know, one time I was Skyping with him and caught him reading about Osama bin Laden and SEAL Team 6 and everything like that. So the guy's not ignoring the conspiratorial side of things. He's actually well versed in it, and so are a lot of these guys who've been doing this work for a long time. But to come around and say these guys are obviously clueless is only really, it only makes your own ignorance of that individual apparent. I mean, it comes to the point that you're not talking about the individual, you're talking about your imagination of that individual.
Sure. Totally.
I mean, because these people, I mean, we're all in the same stew. We're all pretty much obsessed with conspiracy theory and this. And some people just aren't convinced of certain things. But, I mean,
right.
Jesus, you know.
I think that there's, I don't know, there's something to be said for when you come to something on your own, when you follow a chain of synchronicities and you're just immersed in it. And sometimes there's certain parts of those chains that it's like impossible to see how they couldn't have been intentional. And because it might take an individual a very long time and a lot of energy to follow that chain and then come to some place where everything clicks into place, and then when they show it to somebody, it's like that person that they're showing it to just like they skip all of that work and they're just like shown the finished product and then they have an opinion. And I can see how somebody who follows those things and goes that in depth might not see how it couldn't be a conspiracy, or that there's, you know, some other intelligence at play other than simply the universe. Although the universe is part of what makes these things work. Still, like, I can see what the frustration would be for somebody like that, like, because they're just like somebody just gets the. It's like the work that goes into something they don't get to see, and so they don't see the syntax. It's all about the syntax. Does that make sense?
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's why I think that more nowadays I'm less concerned about proving any opinion of mine and more concerned on presentation. Because I think that that's the most important thing. I don't really want to make a piece and say, this is what this means, I'm more interested in giving people those aha moments. You know what I mean?
Right. But, that's funny that you'd say that. I just, so this most recent collage that I just spent a few months on, I took an image of the Joker, Heath Ledger as the Joker, that just said ha, and then I mirrored it against itself before I realized what it would say. I had mirrored it. So like I mirrored it and then it's all aha. And I was like, what, dude? This is I went out everywhere of fucking Heath Ledger as the Joker. And it actually just says aha if you mirror it, you know?
Right. That well, I think that's all. This is that's what this is all about. I think that what's his name, John Sousa? Is that how you say his name?
I know who you're talking about. Sousa.
The guy, the individual you guys talk. He made a good point in saying the same thing, and I think that that's what it's all about. It's that, you know, that moment when it clicks in people's head and it creates some kind of endorphin or something, where it's that's the whole point. I mean, that's what puns are. That 1.5 meaning of sync is what we're all dealing with, and we're kind of addicted to that feeling we get when we get those aha moments.
Well, isn't there that one? I forget who said it, but it was you know, enlightenment. Everyone achieves enlightenment when they go to bed at night and they dream. Zen is just a trick for doing it while awake.
While you're awake, yeah.
And isn't that what the goal is to merge that deep, deep dreaming Zen or that deep, deep dreaming enlightened brainwave with the conscious moment so that you can better understand exactly what forces are at play in the space between. So you can make it a little bit more... are a little less chaotic, or a little bit more in balance. And so, you know, like, I think that Kotz was doing that with 9/11, with the work, like you said, all that work he did at Brave New World Order and the Blob, and it is extensive, and it is deep, and it's sort of a sanctuary for a troubled mind or for a doubtful mind. And it does a very great job in allowing someone to restore some balance after that event. And I'd hate to continue to connect 9/11 with Jay Kotz's work. I don't know if that's necessarily fair or accurate, but they do seem pretty entwined. I think everyone has 9/11 moments in their own personal life, before 9/11 and after 9/11. But he just used that as a prime sort of collective example of what those sort of earth-shattering or reality-splintering events, what, how they're in common with everybody, that everyone sort of has those moments. So
right. Well, it's a good example because there's these things that are just facts that are in the midst of it. So you can have whatever opinion you want, but you hit somebody with facts and you're like, okay, the builder of the guy who designed these towers, like one of the head fucking guy, is just like, he also designs this sphere, which he admits to be representative of the holy of holies. And then by extension, you have the Kaaba at Mecca. He's saying, this is representative of the Kaaba at Mecca, and we rotate it every 24 hours to symbolize the people on their pilgrimage spinning around this fucking cube. And so you have this thing there, but then it's between the two towers, which are representative of the pillars of the temple. And so it's like, and that calls up so much for, I mean, people who study that, it's just like, that's a mind fuck, because you're like, what, these are the trade centers? What did Jesus do at the temple? He turned over the money changers, like the people that were trading at the temple. We build a temple and then it's all for trade. Like, wow, I don't know. And then obviously you have Solomon takes down the two pillars and takes down the temple, you know. It's like, I don't know, that's just really...
It seems like, well, when you look at the Wiz, it seems to be apparent that that was intentional. But I mean, it gets hairy, and especially with the work that I've done with Andras Jones and stuff like that, and I see just I'll be clear, a small portion of the culture of Hollywood, and probably one of the lowest points of the culture when I visited the convention and whatever. But it became obvious to me that most of these actors are not exactly, you know, doing the sort of work that they would want to be doing. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like so, most people who work jobs.
Right. It is a job. It is certainly a job. But, you know, even Andras Jones, who's done, you know, a dozen, maybe a couple of more movies, he's actually had work with a bunch of with individuals who you would know by face or name, like Viggo Mortensen and things like that. I mean, big names that we know, but they started off in the same place that Andras Jones did. And people seem to take, you know, if you did a sync video with Viggo Mortensen, or like the one that I just did with Uma Thurman, people are going to watch that one a lot more because they recognize the footage that I'm using more than they do the one with Andras Jones. But to me, the Andras Jones one is a bigger statement because it's like, no way is this intentional. But it's probably more syncy than, or easier to sync with than anybody else's. And then this gets into the points where, like, individuals, there was one, the whole Hollywood gay conspiracy thing that was brought up about a certain, you know, offshoot of the sync community. One of the ones that they used as absolute proof of it was that movie Existenz.
Really?
You guys ever seen?
Because I've seen that one, Cronenberg.
What was it? What was the name of the movie?
Existenz with Jude Law.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah, I've seen that with the fucking weird-ass gun and the whole...
Right. Yeah. And they use that one as proof. It's like, well, this one's obviously part of the gay conspiracy. This is like the flagship of the gay conspiracy. And that's a shitty fucking movie. Not only that's a B-movie with a low goddamn budget.
Well, that Scientology movie was a pretty shitty movie.
What's that? The Battlefield Earth.
Right. The point is like you can't really say that like B movies that, you know, most they're not like proof that Hollywood's trying to make us all gay.
Right, but did they know that was going to be a B movie? You never know with these cult classics, man. You put a movie out there, it can be. You know.
But don't you tailor the propaganda to the audience that you're trying to reach with the, you know, like you're not going to make a big mainstream movie and try to put the gay conspiracy in there because that audience is going to probably sniff it out or reject it, or it's not going to work on that audience. So if you do a B movie, something that swims in a sort of, I hate to say, less educated or a less sophisticated crowd, then maybe you can allow that message to work. So like the Battlefield Earth thing, you get all these, you know, cinemaphiles and people who love great movies say, this movie is shit. Well, there's this mirror audience who thinks those people are a bunch of assholes. So they go out and see Battlefield Earth and go, see, I knew those people don't know what they're talking about. That movie's a good movie. You can always find a reflective audience who's going to reject the people who reject the thing that is being presented. And then you can really cater to those people and say, you know what, I'm glad that you agree with us. Those people don't know what they're talking about. And those are the people who probably would never be swayed into Scientology based on a shitty science fiction movie. But if you can kind of, you know, craft like an open door for a slighted percentage of the population, and then you can begin a conversation. And so I think that propaganda definitely plays on those kind of levels. It's you don't go for the big kill. You go for little bits here, over a longer period of time until you can get a critical mass, and then you can work with that critical mass.
Well, there's no way in hell you would hear me say that movies don't influence the thought process of the mass populace. And
who does a few shots to Shaman? Who is that?
It's me, fool.
Okay. Well, you wrote an article. I'm sorry, dude. I am a fool right now. I think I did that on some level. But anyways, you did an article.
I'm just glad you didn't say, who is that asshole? I can't stand that blog.
Okay. You did an article all about this where you showed Robin Williams with the little, like, people keep doing this little circle thing that these people are taking to be an asshole or whatever. And you just – You wrote an article that just was really amazing. I felt like it was the sanest thing in an approach to people's take on things in that way that I had come across. That's awesome. Yeah. No, I don't know. Do you know which one I was talking about? That's what the whole article is about.
USAOK, I think is what it was called.
Okay. Yeah.
USAOK.
I mean, it was quite a while ago.
It was only like 3 blog posts back, but I haven't been doing it. Oh. Yeah, I haven't been doing them as often as I could. But that blog post was basically not meant to say like that there's not – because in my opinion, there is – even if it's not intentional, there's definitely the acceptance of gayness is – I mean we live in a post-Will and Grace society. And yesterday, as a matter of fact, could be a prime example of that. I mean, I don't know about your Facebook, but mine was covered with that equality sign everywhere. And that would not have happened 10 years ago.
Well, the newspapers wouldn't have had that kind of coverage. The magazines wouldn't have had that kind of coverage. The televisions wouldn't have had that kind of coverage. But the Facebook media stream, which in all media streams is just as influential, I believe, that is the one section of media that is open to that kind of mass coverage or that mass wave of support for even just a symbol like that, right? I mean,
right. Well, it's the point that it's the exposure therapy that just gets people to be more accepting more than like turning them – changing their sexual orientation. Sorry for interrupting.
Well, the thing that I wanted to say was that I can't imagine that there – you'd have to be pretty closed off and pretty dedicated to a pretty close-minded group of people if that symbol did not find its way into your Facebook thread or your Facebook newsfeed, right? There would have to be one person in your group of friends who posted that it would seem pretty unavoidable for just about every single person on Facebook. And I gather to say that at least 90% of the however many hundreds of millions of people on Facebook had that symbol cross their computer screen during that day. And that's just incredible.
Yeah.
And imagine if it was a swastika.
Right.
And we woke up yesterday and there were just swastikas. Everyone saying, "Hey, did you hear about this new guy? Got some great ideas." And put this in.
Well, that's a good point. I got in this argument with a Republican one time, and he was like, I was saying, what about PBS? And he was like, "No, PBS is the worst thing on the planet." And he was like, "You want to know what TV to pay attention to? I'll tell you what TV to pay attention to. You pay attention to the TV that has the highest ratings." And he broke it down and was saying stuff like, it's because of the money and the advertisement and so forth and so on. And this is – and I was like, well, wait a second. You know, Hitler had a high approval rating.
You're going to listen to like Murdoch. Murdoch is like a criminal in other countries and they're letting him have the biggest fucking TV station here. He'd be arrested if he went to certain places. For what he did. Like, it's crazy. Like, and he's like, and we got Fox News. Like, what the fuck? Like, it's admittedly propaganda. Like, what are we watching? Like, this is propaganda, admittedly.
Well, that's what he was telling me to watch. He was saying Fox News has got the highest rating for a reason. Because it's the best thing out there.
Well, that doesn't equal that. That's not like...
It doesn't.
Correlation doesn't equal causation or whatever.
propaganda exists, and the molding of opinion exists, the construction of consent exists. And it just take Santa Claus, for example. I mean, kids believe in Santa Claus because of the movies they watch. I mean, the amount of people killing sharks went up after Jaws.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that happens. But I don't necessarily think that Uma Thurman, you know, being in a garden in every single one of her or most of her movies has an effect on people. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It seems to be different territory to me.
Right. Well, I mean, it's in people's vulnerability to being impressed, you know, to have an impression put on them that's like that becomes integrated. There was a study that was done not that long ago on basically like how people, if they identify with a character in a work of fiction, how that affects their own like the way that they relate to themselves. Like they will literally like invoke a character, and like there was a legitimate study that was looking at that phenomenon. And there's a lot of truth to it. So if you are really into a certain figure, and you start like, and it's a completely energetic thing that you take on certain characteristics of that individual. Just like if you had a partner or a friend who you spent a lot of time with, and you start taking on certain mannerisms of them, it can work the same with a character in fiction. Which is kind of a trip. So one of the arguments that they were coming up with that was it was about violence in video games, which is another example. Like I just said, I don't see the correlation necessarily equaling causation. Just because somebody plays a lot of video games doesn't mean that they're identifying with the character in the same way that they would if they got into, you know, Steinbeck or Bruce Willis. You know, it's like, it doesn't necessarily follow, but at the
Steinbeck
same,
or Bruce yeah. Willis.
That's like an interesting pairing.
I was just giving two extreme examples.
Yeah, oh, I love it though.
You can get into a writer, you can get into an actor, or whatever, and those were the first two that came to mind. But you know what I'm saying? Like, there's this, and yeah. So I think about like the Greek gods. And like how people would identify with like their god of choice, if they have a resonance with a god, then they're like take on their, and especially like people in like higher positions and whatnot, when they're like, oh, I'm this, because like, I mean, that was a thing, right, with Caligula. He'd like choose a god. He's like, I'm fucking Jupiter this week, you know, and he is Jupiter, you know. It's like he was doing that, like that, and you know.
Well, see, I seem to think that it has less to do with, I think the god is a part of the archetype. Like, everybody zeroes down 42 means Jupiter, and to me, it seems to be more clear that 42 is part of the same, you know, symbol set as Jupiter. But to say right. that it's highlighted as Jupiter being the source, and people, I think, jump to that conclusion as well. They're always like, well, you know, Jupiter did this and Jupiter did that. He's a terrible role model. But there's more to it than that. Jupiter is only part of the archetype. He is not like the end all of the archetype.
Well, here it goes back to what we were talking about earlier of intent or synchronicity, or what does it mean? The new Jackie Robinson movie that's coming out in a couple mm-hmm. of weeks. I just saw the preview in the theater, and they the name of the movie is 42,
right.
But the whole preview is like about the fact that he's wearing 42, and someone even says to him, maybe one day we'll all be wearing 42.
And they do. I went to a baseball game a couple of years back, and every player on the field was wearing 42.
And you just think, like, okay, well, you could just use that as a way to tell a story and to focus on something. But you just wonder, I don't know. It just seemed too obviously related to something more. And if it's related to something beyond just Jackie Robinson's jersey number, well, then people who go scratching around the internet, you just punch in 42, you're going to come across, you know, a thread that takes you, I think, into the synchrosphere, right? I mean, it's a perfect invitation to kind of pull at that thread. And
right. It's a coliseum in the first place. Like, this is like, those people are supposed to be like titans, right? When you're watching, if you're watching football, and like, isn't there there's a whole geometry to the football field itself. It's like the golden rectangle or something. There's like, we should have Justin Morgan on here.
Baseball field is the, it could be interpreted to be clear
it's square and compass.
The square and compass.
Oh yeah. Wow. I never thought of it that way.
Yeah, turn it upside down.
Time I look at the thing, I'm just like, I'm looking at a square and compass right now. This is like what this baseball diamond is. I love it that people throw up the diamond symbol, right? You got Jay-Z with the fucking diamond symbol, and then it's like, dude, you're showing me. If you're not showing me a pyramid, you're showing
that's
me a square.
That's the rock, man. That pisses me off so bad. Like, everybody says it's the eye and the pyramid or whatever, and it's not. It's not a triangle. It's a diamond. Like.
Right.
It's not the capstone, it's a diamond, because the name of his thing is Rockefeller, and it's the rock.
Which in itself is the Rockefellers in their mitts, you know what I'm saying? Like the at the Ritz, have you ever seen that? Like the old version of when the guy's singing at the Ritz, and he's like talking about the Rockefellers, and you're in their mitts. It's like, basically, like the Rockefellers have always been, I mean, to call it Rockefeller is like, that in the first fucking place is like, look, we're doing a thing here, but... I don't know. Not to get into all of that. I was just basically emphasizing that when you're looking at the structure of the game itself, every single aspect of it is intentional in terms of the archetypal nature. Like if you look at like Plato's idea of the forms behind forms, well, that's the significance of sacred geometry in a game like that, because you have the foundation of the game, then everything that extends from it becomes an emanation of that foundation. And so every aspect of it, how many innings, like what the fuck, you know, like everything. So I don't know. It's interesting.
Yeah, I agree with you. That why did certain games have such a hold on people, and why do they have the forms that they have? It's kind of, it doesn't seem as mysterious to me now as it once did. I feel like SyncWork kind of gives you something to hold on to kind of understand why the universe chose something like baseball to kind of create an arena for something that was entertaining not only to play but also to watch. And it just seems to fit right in. Like there's a place for it within the structures of these kind of transcendent forms. So it does kind of make sense.
Yeah.
So how are you guys? You guys got a good bracket going right now for the NCAA tournament?
Oh man,
I don't follow sports anymore.
Yeah, my wife does though. My wife's got a good bracket.
49ers every fucking game, just intensity in 10 cities. Like my dad was just obsessed, and his entire mood would always depend on how the 49ers were doing. So if they lost a game, he was like upset until the next game if they won. You know what I mean? Like, and it just went on like that every season for my entire childhood. It was intense.
One of the best way to control your emotions, man. Athletics.
Well, the 80s was a very positive time for him.
Thank you, Joe Montana.
Yeah, dude, thank you. Nice. Thank you, Ronnie Lott. Thank you, Bubba Paris. You guys are awesome. Yeah.
Good gracious, googly moogly.
So how was, I just saw that you completed 42 minutes with Mr. Green.
Yeah, it probably won't be up till later this evening when Alan gets back and puts it on the website, but it went pretty well. I mean, we ended up talking about the same stuff that we started talking about here. but that's because that's a big topic that's highlighted in his book. You know, his book dealing with the assassinations of the presidents. And, you know, he highlights other people's work. I think he did it correctly. I mean, he basically says, this is the work that, you know, that my work is based off, but this is where I disagree. Do you get what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And, but we went over a little bit. It's longer. It was 42 minutes, and then we have some green room that will probably be out later on. But it went well, you know, Alan. We were all tired. I'd been on the road all day, and Alan, now that he's working long hours, was kind of wiped out for sure. But it definitely went well. Alan he's one of the best, you know?
Yeah, he's bringing something really important to that table, because there's so many people working on those lines of the King Kill thing, and I really appreciate how unfear-based his approach is in the first place. And on top of that, just I like his angle on it. I think it's really important. I've been really into, where I was introduced to that was through Hollywood. So Marilyn Manson was obsessed with the King Kill 33 thing. And then I found an internet copy of that book, and then I get into it and I'm like, wow, this is really, really anti-Semitic. And at the same time, I can't help but agree with like a large part of what this guy is saying. Yet the parts I disagree with, I really disagree with. And so Alan is really helful in that he doesn't even bother to like, you know, present it as, he doesn't take that position one way or the other, which is like really ideal. It's like what we tend to emphasize here is like, you know, it's so easy to do that and to get caught up in that. And that's rad that he was able to write a whole book without having to play that game so much, you know.
Does he have any timetable as for when that book is going to be?
I don't know if we fucking asked him. I don't know if we asked him or not. I imagine that he would try to. If it doesn't come out this summer, I know that he's nearly complete with it. But I mean, since we're coming up on the anniversary, what is it, like the 50-year anniversary or something of the assassination of JFK? It's, in my opinion, that would be the smartest thing to do. I know that there was a time where I was like editing the show, so he and Doug might have mentioned it then, and I had not paid attention. But like I said, we were all tired, so there's probably quite a few things that slipped through my noggin. Because my noggin is quite slippery.
I always think of that day because my father had his 16th birthday the day that John F. Kennedy was shot.
And 16 candles.
Boom.
Oh god.
Oh man, that takes the cake.
Anybody out there see the new Wizard of Oz movie? Oz the Great and Powerful.
I haven't watched it yet. It is that. Out.
And the other high profile movie that James Franco is in is Spring Breakers,
where he plays Alien.
Alien. So he's playing Oz and he's playing Alien. And
Definitely. Wait a minute. There's an alien in Spring Breakers?
Rapper named Alien.
Named Alien.
Oh, I was like, I saw a preview for that. It didn't seem like that. It was oriented.
It's a fantastic movie. I definitely recommend it.
Oz is a fantastic movie.
Oz is a piece of shit. Spring Breakers is phenomenal.
I like to watch Oz with the volume of Spring Break over it. That's what I'm about.
I don't know if you guys are aware of the films of Harmony Korine, but I definitely think that this movie is kind of a masterpiece on some level.
Do you mean by the sequel to Midnight Cowboy?
Absolutely. I definitely...
Could you elaborate on that a little bit? Because I think I get the idea with Spring Breakers, though I haven't seen it, what its premise is. I mean, I get it. The girls, like, rob some schmo so that they can have party down for spring break, and then they get involved with this drug dealer who's, like, you know, gets them into some business or whatever. But how is that related to Midnight Cowboy?
Well, okay, so... Stemming from something I heard Harmony Korine say on David Letterman back in the day when he was promoting Kids, and he was like 19, and he said with Kids he wanted to make a sequel to Caddyshack. So, you know, you either think that is just a throwaway, absurdist line, or you try to meditate on that and try to make any connection. So with Spring Breakers and how it connects to Midnight Cowboy, you know, Midnight Cowboy gets released in 1969, and it has this character, Joe Buck, in this, you know, dead, no-fun town in Texas, who hears that, you know, rich white women want studs out in New York City. And if he just goes to New York City, he can just sleep with, you know, old rich women, and he can live the life and, you know, say goodbye to Dullsville. And, you know, it was an X-rated film that won Best Picture. And you go back and you look at it, and it's very difficult to kind of, you know, standards of that day are obviously so different. But you even think for 1969, for that to be an X-rated movie, considering how we associate the X rating, but really it was just, it was an adult
I think
film.
It's that Velvet Underground was X rated. I don't know if it was actually the content as much as it was the context, if that makes any sense. I feel like that whole scene was something that Hollywood didn't want to acknowledge or have anything to do with.
I agree. I think that it was X rated for reasons that are completely removed from how today's audiences think of the X rating or the NC-17 rating. So
it's the religious aspect of it too, with the cross and the whole that whole deal. But anyway, it's
going on. Spring Breakers was just R, though, wasn't it?
It was, but it is
it
definitely
NC-17 or anything like that. I mean, you don't see a naked Selena Gomez or anything like that.
Selena does not get naked, but the other three certainly do.
Hutchinson gets naked.
If I remember my boobs correctly, but it's definitely pornographic. It is a pornographic movie. There's just no doubt. And
they don't show insertion or anything. There's no penetration. Huh?
I don't think there would be what you would call hardcore pornography.
What about?
But it's definitely softcore pornography. It's definitely more graphic than anything you'd find on a Skinemax or a Showtime.
I'll have to watch that with my wife then.
But the undercurrent of it, you know, considering how it's marketed, but the actual product is something far darker. Something that sort of takes the imagery of the beach party that's going on MTV, you know, with all the young people dancing in, you know, differing levels of clothing or not clothing, that, you know, that spring break party.
Different tempos of gyration.
Different tempos of gyration, rhythms, thrusting. But you
it's
see this.
Dubsteppy, right? That's the thing. It's like, do they play a bunch of dubstep in the movie? Is that like gangster?
Well, it's there. I mean, I don't have as much of a connection to the technical aspects of the music, but the music definitely drives.
Does it go womp, 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 like,
so, yeah, absolutely.
Is it womping?
It's definitely womping. It's womping.
There is some womping going on.
But there, I almost walked out about 30 minutes into the movie because I felt so uncomfortable. And especially.
You went with your grandma?
It's funny, when I walked into the theater, I saw about five dudes over the age of 55 sitting in random places throughout the theater, which was just a little bit creepy.
Of course you did. They were hoping to see Selena Gomez with no top on, guaranteed.
But you really need to see this film, because I just, the fact that this director pulled it off as well as he did, the fact that he marketed it in the way that he has, the fact that it's completely blown by most of the critical reviews that I've read of it, it's just a searing, dark reality that he's presenting underneath it all. And I think it gets to that sort of idealism of Midnight Cowboy, where this simple person who's far removed, I guess it's sort of like an Oz in a sense, you know, that you think that it's
a better...
So
the drug dealer is Ratso? Sorry, I keep interrupting. I'm having one of those days.
No, that's good. I wouldn't say necessarily, but you could definitely make a parallel that they go to this paradise, and the person that they connect themselves with is someone who's from the very kind of I wouldn't say bottom of society, but definitely removed from mainstream society, kind of hustling in the underbelly part of what makes maybe a certain angle of Miami run. I don't know. I don't think it's going to get the recognition it deserves. I think it's a work of genius. I haven't felt this kind of excited about a movie since I'm Still Here, the Joaquin Phoenix
wow
film, which is just genius.
You blow my mind sometimes, Klaus. I would not expect for you to say that Spring Breakers changed you.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, no. I mean, how could you tell from the preview of what you're going to get, you know?
Oh, this is like Porky's Part 15 or something.
Right, that's what you would think, right? And with I'm Still Here, it was a movie that, you know, with all the kind of hype and the press, it just was sort of like, oh, it's just, it's a joke. It's a practical joke. It's devoid of any meaning or whatever. But you watch that movie and you get to the core of it. I mean, it's a game changer.
Huh. You know, there's that thing about when what it is that you're bringing to the table and what it is that you see in something. You know, there's obviously that personal projection side to how you relate to a film. I had this whole, you know, I've been obsessed with Lady Gaga recently, and I was talking about it last week, and I've been watching Metropolis and Marie Antoinette over and over and over again with Fame Monster and Born This Way, and like I can read into it like all of this stuff, but then I was reading into Marie Antoinette yesterday just on its own level in terms of the Sofia Coppola film itself. Like, dude, these people are American. This is about America. That's the whole statement. Because the first time I saw it, I was like, what the fuck? They let them film this at Versailles and they let them do the whole thing like as if it was like a historical documentation of something. I was like, this is not a historical documentation. This is actually a joke on what's happening in America, that America is doing the same thing, that the people in power are looking at themselves as royalty and living it up. And that the whole thing is fucking going to come down, like, you know, and that. So in this regard, Lady Gaga is looking at, she's emphasizing that throughout the album. And you can see that in the Born This Way thing as a joke on that we have the same DNA. Like, she has this little sample in there where it goes, same DNA. And like, just as she's looking at the picture of Jason Schwartzman, who she's about to marry, and it's that they're related. So that even though they're getting married, and even though she's from Austria, and even though he's from France, you know, they're still like, they're in the same family in the first fucking place. Like, everybody's in the same family. And so you're born this way, you're born into royalty. So like, that's the whole joke that she's putting in everyone's face, because they're like all the teenage girls are listening to it and they're like, yeah, I was just born this way. And she's like, you know, you're born into your circumstances. It's like there's a caste system here or something, you know. But in other words, I was just expressing that, like, there's always what insight you're bringing into something that influences the way you see it. It's like all those people who watched 2001 back in the day, like Siskel and Ebert, are all, oh, two thumbs down. You're like saying this movie's not going to receive the recognition it deserves, but that's not a new thing. That's been happening for fucking ever. That, I mean, Midnight Cowboy is like a rare example. It's like, wow, how did that get that kind of recognition on that level? It seemed like there was something else going on there. Is probably, I'll tell you why that happened, is because fucking Dustin Hoffman was in The Graduate, which got nothing, no recognition, right. And then he's Ratso in that, and so they're like, okay, well, this is a movie to pay attention to. If fucking Dustin Hoffman wasn't in that shit after Graduate, I don't know if it would have gotten any of the kind of you know, acknowledgement that it received.
Like Denzel Washington in Training Day, like.
Mm-hmm.
Denzel Washington wins an Oscar for Training Day, and you're like, of all the fucking things that Denzel did, like Glory and everything else, you give him an Oscar for Training Day?
Right.
It's just bizarre. It's like the Training Day would not have gotten the recognition. Yeah, it's a good shoot 'em up movie, but is it an Oscar? No, it's like your typical, like...
Yeah, well, the Academy is fucking bullshit, and it's all like it's like a club, and it's all
politics.
Like people, like, they're everyone's sucking each other's dicks in there and licking each other's clits, and that's what goes on. It's like it's a
you made that statement three times as vulgar by burping in the middle of it.
I just drank like a coffee, a cold coffee drink this year. So that's what.
But I just, you know, psyching cock is like, let alone. I mean, that's kind of a grotesque statement, but to add a punctuation with a belch is like,
totally.
That's like twice the dig at the Academy that it was before that.
About the Academy Awards too, I'm just like,
and that's what the Academy Awards, you almost vomited because they discussed you so much.
But the point was, I stopped watching them pretty much or really caring was when they gave the fucking, they, okay, so Requiem for a Dream, the actress from fucking Exorcist, like, what's her name? Like, that amazing actress, I should remember her name because I felt so strongly about it at the time. But, you know, she was getting nominated for Best Supporting Actress or Best Actress. And I was like, fuck yeah, dude. She was so good. Requiem for a Dream, where she's the
Helen Burstyn, is it?
Oh, she's the mom.
Yeah.
She's amazing mom. In that.
Amazing, dude. And then they gave it to, like, Julia Roberts for Erin Brockovich because of the feminist side of Erin Brockovich. And I'm like, dude, I know in the first place, like, this is about, like, whatever issues it is that Hollywood's into at the time. Like, if something, like, right. Okay, if that comes out about AIDS, when everyone's concerned about AIDS, give it to Tom Hanks, Philadelphia. Yeah, I get it. It was a good, he did a good job of acting, but it was a subject matter that got him the Oscar. And I was just like, you know what, dude? Fuck this. Why am I watching this? Why do I even care? Like, people, like, nice. Give a little gold statue. What is that based off of again? The Oscar itself? Like, I forget what the symbolism of is.
It's Freemasonic. It's Freemasonic, I'm sure. We don't even have to know the details. Where did the...
But that Yeah. You gonna look it up?
Yeah, because I don't know. I probably should know because it's probably, like, obvious.
Well, isn't James Franco in Oz? Isn't his name Oscar?
Well, his name is Harry Osborn, and I do remember him having the name Oscar, which... What? That seems familiar to me. But it would make sense because Franco's loaded, man. But this is another prime example. I mean, the guy still does soap operas because you know what I mean? Because it's money in his pocket. It's like, I don't know if he still does. I know he was doing them for quite a long time. He started off on, holy shit, the guy's almost the same age as I am. So it doesn't make any sense to me. Like, shit, he was Osborne Silver in Hollywood Heights, which is a TV series.
Osborne.
Yeah, he was, of course, Oz the Great and Powerful. I didn't know he played Hugh Hefner, too. Fabulous Silas. Soul? Harry Osborn in the Spider-Man series. I don't see an Oscar. He did host the Oscars. That's another person named Osborn, though, in his... That's kind of interesting to me. That's three Oz's for...
He's Oscar Diggs in Oz the Great and Powerful. Oscar Oz Diggs.
Oh, so in the movie, the new movie, he's also called, his name was Oscar?
His name is Oscar, Oscar Diggs, and his nickname is Oz. So it's the Oscar magic that, you know, kicks the queen out of the castle and establishes, you know, a new regime.
So really, that movie was crap, you're saying?
Yeah, it was a piece of shit. I mean, it's for kids. I mean, it's like, what is it? Olympus, what's the movie? Olympus Has Fallen or whatever? I went and saw that, and after 25 minutes, I just picked up my stuff and left without even, you know, any regrets. You just, when you see shit, you know it's shit, and then you just go on your way. Not a big deal. I stayed to the end of Oz just for the fact that it was, you know, connected to the whole mythology of it, and just for so that if people did find something in there that I didn't see, I could have a reference point. But it's pretty vanilla. Doesn't take very many chances. Kind of a labor to get through. But I guess I should have smoked pot for it.
You know, the Oscar statue, he holds a sword in his hands and stands atop a five-spoke film reel representing the original five branches of the Academy. It's like a pentagram, right? I mean, they say it's the five branches of the Academy. It could be four elements and spirit or whatever. Who knows? But the woman who's widely attributed to coining the term Oscar, it says here that she said it looked like her Uncle Oscar.
Right.
And that's why she called that. But what's interesting is that the name Oscar literally means spear of the gods. And so, I don't know, I was like, that's kind of weird. Oscar has four variant forms, one of which is Ozzy. O-Z-Z-Y.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's weird. I mean, even this seems like it was pretty much an impromptu thing. Do you know what I mean? For something that, for a society that has so many negative conspiratorial attachments to it, such as Hollywood, it seems that the making of the Oscar is pretty impromptu.
Uh-huh.
It's just kind of a spur-of-the-moment thing. Which seems to be how most of Hollywood works. It seems to be more inspirational. I mean, have you ever noticed how movies are kicked around and scripts are written and rewritten and people are having arguments and things of that nature? It would seem pretty clear to me that it would be difficult to execute so much consistent symbolism with any accuracy at all.
Yeah, it reminds me of the stock market in Pi, where he's just like looking at the stock market as a natural organism, that it's a million human hands at work, a million minds. So, like, to find a pattern within something of that nature would, I mean, that would
something
be really
so powerful. Organic, right?
Something so organic, and Hollywood is very organic, but yet at the same time, it's not.
Well, there is propaganda. There's no doubt about it, and there is, you know, the war propaganda and persuasion and opinion making and setting. I mean, there's a reason why they get movie stars to do car commercials and things like that. Nearly all commercials are voiced over by recognizable stars such as Kevin Spacey and Jeff Bridges, and all of these cats are always doing these voiceovers for these commercials because we are familiar with these voices, and I understand all of that. But it seems more of a money thing than anything else. And it seems to me that Hollywood is mostly ran off of money. And most of the decision-makings that they make, or most of the decisions that they make, the decision-making process is dictated by the trends as far as what movie makes what, who did good in the box office, and things of that nature. Now, individuals such as Kubrick is a totally different story.
Mm-hmm.
Because that guy could do whatever. He could do bad movies if he wanted to. He did bad movies on purpose. And, you know, I've started to see The Shining as a bad movie.
But it's supposed to be in a weird way. Like, if you go to see that as a midnight movie, like, people can't not laugh. Like, it's fucking hilarious. Like, that movie could be seen as a comedy just as easily. Like, it really can. Like, I've seen people experience it as such. And it's not just, like, it seems like that's almost, like, in the design of the thing, that you don't have to be looking at it through this, like, uncanny, heavy lens. Like, you can transcend that, and that's like, it's hysterical. It's like an invite into the willingness of just like embracing insanity, which is just hysterical. Like, there's that whole other side to it, and it's not. Yeah, I think, does it sound like I'm kind of am I on the same page in my response to what you're saying, or is that?
Yeah, it's just there's a certain part of it that's not to be taken seriously. With the way that he puts the days of the week up, it just seems loose. It seems intentionally loose.
Yeah, intentionally. It seems very intentional. Like, that's the thing, because he doesn't have to do it that way. Okay, the other thing with Oscar is that it also can mean, I don't know how you say it, Gaelic phrase, Oscara, meaning friend of the deer. And, of course, the gazelle is equated with the Shakina. And so you can see the Oscar as, like, a friend of the stone that the builders rejected, which is kind of...
Well, you could also see, like, the friend of the... the friend of the deer or the friend of the stag, and how that relates to the silver screen and its relationship to the moon and the flicker rate being the phases of the moon and so forth.
Oh, totally. Yeah, absolutely. And so, and then, yeah, there's
the silver of the screen and the gold of the Oscar.
Wow. What a trip. What did you mention earlier about the, I think Bill, you were talking about, oh boy, you were talking about Zen, and you were saying that. Oh God, I'm not gonna.
That enlightenment is achieved. Everyone achieves enlightenment in their sleep, but Zen is just a trick for doing it while awake.
Exactly. So that brought to mind, although it's not Zen, but Sri Ramana Maharshi in the 30s equated. He basically used film as a metaphor for everything, like in spirituality, and was explaining the way that you have the projector is like the pure eye sense, and the picture on the screen is ego, and the backdrop of the screen is the void or the emptiness that everything is projected onto, that there's actually no real substance to our material world, that it's all this projection, and that we are the audience member is also like identifying with what's going on the screen. And because they're so entrenched in that, they can't turn around to see the pure eye sense that's projecting the whole thing. And he said the same thing. He didn't say Zen, but he was way into talking about how sleep is the same thing that we're talking about here. Like in terms of enlightenment, like he was like, if you were to dream consciously, or to sleep consciously, that's like the same thing we're talking about. It's that people don't see that they're dreaming, and so in the waking world, and so that's like the main deterrent to, you know, the double awakening, so to speak.
Well, isn't it that so lucid dreaming, right? Most stoner kind of people who are kind of getting into that sort of things eventually are looking for any way to turn on and different ways to kind of excite their brain. And lucid dreaming usually is a concept that is discussed or flirted with. And, you know, I've read the books. I can honestly say, and a couple of times through willed intention, I've woken up in a dream and been, holy shit, this is this.
I did it quite regularly and became pretty damn good at it. I stopped, however, when I started having multiple wake-ups, because I can't deal with that. Multiple wake-ups or the scariest, and because you never know when you're awake, when it happens like three times and then you finally wake up and you're like, though, and it keeps getting more real every time, I stop screwing around with it. But I'm sorry, I'm interrupting. What were you saying?
But that's a safer kind of that's a safer way to tap into that how am I trying to say this? You're asleep in your bed, and so you, on some level, if you're going into lucid dreaming, you know that you're going to wake up in your bed, right? Mm. Well, I think that sync work is a way of dreaming while awake. It's that it's trying to interpret everything in your environment as a symbol and trying to tap into that unconscious meta language, but while awake. And the problem is that the tools that one uses to kind of get into that state of mind, you can get into a lot more trouble while inverting the lucid dreaming thing. I don't know if I'm...
No, you totally spot on, dude. And like,
well, it comes from the same source, for sure. I mean, it's been said even by Jung that symbolism and dreams and the symbolism of synchronicity, they share a relationship. And of course, well, back to William S. Burroughs, he did the same thing. He said that dream, speech, and cut-ups come from the same source.
Mm-hmm. Keep going, sorry.
No. I was just going to add on the whole delirium speech, the incoherent talk, the mashing up of language, the incoherency of dream speech comes from the same place as cut-ups.
Absolutely.
Because it all has to do with, and that's what we do when we rearrange letters and so forth. We're basically tapping into that dream state, that right brain area,
right,
of understanding.
Because I'm trying to get to this a fuller understanding of the middle pillar in the tree of life.
Of what?
Of the middle pillar.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
So
yeah,
I would equate lucid dreaming as I don't know where to assign the pillar of mercy and the pillar of severity, but I would equate lucid dreaming as a sort of opposite pillar to that sort of dreaming while awake.
Well, I would say
that's
pretty close because, in my opinion, to be clear, severity would be the left brain and mercy would be the right brain. So, you know, the severity or judgment, I've also heard it called judgment, it would be the left brain, or Yasid would be, no, not Yasid, Gabura would
Hesed.
Gabura would be the separation of this and that. I am this, I am not that. The judgmental severity, the weighing of things, where language comes from. However, mercy would be, this is the same as me. Does that make sense? So you have mercy on something. You accept the non-barrier between this and the other. The middle pillar, so in my opinion, when you're dreaming, you would be in the full, you'd be closer to God. You'd be in the full, the Sephiroth number four. Yes, when you're awake, you would be more in Gabura, which is number five, which, of course, you know, out of 10, five is where, you know, where it would be the halfway point where spirit meets matter, if that makes sense. Mm. So the twin pillars would be a combination of both, or the firing of both brains, sides of the brain at the same time. That would make
right.
sense. I could see where you would say that.
It would make more sense in terms of Netzach and Hod, actually, because Yesod is the first veil between. So you have Malkut is our whole like our perceptual world. That's our consensus reality that we're kind of holding together and kind of keeping on a lower state in order to function as we're functioning, in order to establish an empire, which is how Malkut literally translates, is this is our empire, right? And so we need this to stay a certain way. So to move beyond that at all is into the dream realm, which is Yesod. Now, Netzach and Hod are the two like parallel corollaries, right? That might be redundant, but they're the initial split of the right and left brain. When you get beyond Tiferet into like Chesed and Gevurah, as you're saying, that's another level of lucidity, even beyond just like being aware that you're dreaming. But to be aware that you're dreaming, and to be aware that the dreamer is the dream, and that, you know, the thinker is the thought, the one thinking these thoughts is itself a thought. So who am I? Like, that's a whole other a whole other level to the processing. But I think that there's that you guys are really spot on in like in the first place, like the idea of the middle pillar being like, you know, there's when it comes to Gevor and Chesed or Netzach and Hod, there's a distinction, but there's no separation. And that middle path is the transcendent path. It's like the only way beyond is directly through, right? And so the only way to reconcile the opposites is to, you know, move beyond their opposition. And so for you to say, like, you know, the waking world and the dream world, I mean, that's level to level, you know, to further and further depth. But the polarity of right and left brain, the constraint and the freeness are definitely mutually interdependent.
See, because I look at the printed Tree of Life as really an abomination on
sure.
some level.
Totally. It is.
Okay. Because it has held me back as much as it has put me in a position. I guess it's the whole, if you see the Buddha in the road,
yeah, I hear
kill
you.
Him. If you see the Tree of Life printed on a piece of paper, light it on fire. Kind of
right, I have it tattooed on me, but I know that I'll eventually be lit on fire.
if you see Billy Graham on TV, change the channel, that sort of thing.
Right. Well, these are spiraling spheres. You're supposed to be looking. This is what's far out. Is like we're not supposed to know, right? Like about how we're all like the sun is the center of our. You know, solar system, and that we're spinning through space in giant whirling spirals around the center. That is exactly how the Tree of Life is articulated in the older text. Like they're like literally like you're to visualize these spherot as whirling through space as a spiral in a very particular set of dynamic patterns, and those patterns are meant to be looked at in everything. That extends out of them. So our whole perceptual world is like a substitute reality, but at the same time can't help but follow the same dynamics as the underlying reality. So though we're projecting a manifest world that is ultimately illusory, it has to follow the same dynamics. And so that's why the ideas around the archetypes and synchronicity resonate so strongly for me when it comes to Kabbalah. Is that not what we're talking about? Like, I don't see how that doesn't connect on any level. Like, that's totally it. Like, there is an underlying set of dynamics, and although this is all made up, it's reflecting a greater reality. And that's why Yesod is, you know, for the Golden Dawn people, they equate it with the moon, which is really appropriate, even though it's equated with Jupiter in the older system, and Malkut is equated with Saturn. And there's this constant interplay of Saturn and Jupiter mythologically following that. But then at the same time, if you look at it as the moon and then we're the earth, there's this relationship. We spin with the moon around the sun. Like we have a relationship to the moon that's different from our relationship to the planets, obviously, because we're spinning with the moon around this other center. And so our relationship to Yesod, which is the dream world, is the same thing. And so we're spinning with our dream world back and forth, waking and dreaming around the center that is Tiferet. So, yeah, it's a trip.
Because
see, I think it's cool because I'm saying it. My pronunciation is so terrible.
Well, that's fine. You read it. How are you supposed to know? Like...
Well, Yassid or Mercy, yeah, to me, all the symbolism in movies and stuff always comes down to like alien communication, nonverbal communication, mm-hmm. telepathy and stuff of that nature. So it always seems to be like a prime example is The Fourth Kind with Mia Jovovich, right? So you have Mia with the fourth kind, which is the fourth Sephiroth. To me, it like totally highlights that. But she always sees owls. Like everybody sees owls. And sometimes Mercy is not only associated to Jupiter, but it's also associated to Athena or Minerva or everything that she has to do with owls. But also, Mia Jovovich was in that movie, The Messenger. Have you ever seen that movie?
Yeah.
About Joan of Arc?
Mm-hmm.
Real kind of artsy-fartsy movie, but they lead you to believe that she's actually talking to aliens. Sometimes she goes out into the fields and she sees these lights in the sky. And, of course, Athena is always armed, just like Joan of Arc.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole concept of like, I keep playing with this idea that alien communication and the thread of, like, Whitley Strieber and everything, where they see an alien and he's talking to him, but he's not using his mouth, is always more like more akin to dream symbolism, or the whole getting. What Jung says that the upper three, or the Sephiroths, are more in tune with intuition. And
with what?
With intuition.
Oh yeah.
And so, the Sephiroth of Mercy seems to be the connecting point of how we get nonverbal communication, or gnosis, the knowing without knowing how you know, our intuition.
Right. Well, they're ultimately meant to be the same thing. There's a divide that's down the center. So, and then that's why Tiferet is represented as a Vav with a Yud on top, which becomes a Zion, which literally means sword. So there's this whole symbolism there, because the top, then once again, the Yud is taken as representative of a crown. So what do you see above Tiferet but Da'at in the place of the crown, which is Keter? It's a placeholder. And then that becomes our perceptual reality, right? So there's this thing that's in the, something in the way, right? It's like this thing that's there that it's like, what is this? And it's also Metatron. So Metatron is taken to be Da'at. You have the six directions, right? So we have like the cube of space, but it's not really the cube of space. It's just like this, like I said, a placeholder for the actual cube of space. Because the whole tree is meant to be folded into itself, and it wants to do so. And so there has to be this force pushing it apart, like fucking Samson, right? It's like holding everything in its place. And that is actually what Christ is made to represent, is the thing that's holding it in place so that the empire can establish itself. That's why he wears a crown of thorns. His crown of thorns is Da'at. It's the substitute crown. It's not the real crown.
It's not the real crown. Yes.
And it's fucking painful.
Wow. That's cool. That's cool.
He's in pain. So, and then he needs to be for Rome to be powerful. Like, that's its whole deal. And so that's, I mean, it's not the actual it's this other thing that they literally say that Christianity was grafted onto the Judaic tree. And so you had, you know, the Sicarii and the Jewish rebels who are trying to, they're anti the occupation of the Roman rule. And so what does Rome do but comes up with the gospel? Like, that's a whole thing to get into. And there's a huge argument for that. The first Christians were all of the Flavian court of gospel Christians. And so people hear about Christians getting killed. They're not hearing about gospel Christians getting killed. They're hearing about the Sicarii, the Jewish rebels, getting killed for Christianity. But their Christianity is not gospel Christianity. So, but the symbolism is very particular. That's why you'll see Jesus grafted on to the tree of life. Like, he's hanging from the tree of life at Adam Kadmon. He becomes the new Adam, so to speak. It's really, like, that's a really far out thing to think about. But this ties directly into the strength card. And this is something I keep coming back to, because the strength card as Leo is the sun, right? So you have the son of God, and the strength that Jesus is, the force that is there, is the very effector metric.